Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's Friday, and that means it's time for our media roundtable, the day we discuss coverage of the week's news with a roundtable of journalists. The midterm elections are in full swing, and they're expected to be the most expensive in history. I think we say that every time there's an election nowadays. Open Secrets and other groups that follow the money say this election is shaping up to be the darkest election in a long time. Today's guest, Dave Leventhal, reports that by November, more than $150 million will be spent on television ads. So far, more than 428,000 TV ads have run, many in very small states. Dave Leventhal is senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, where he leads its Consider the Source project team, investigating the influence of money in politics. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rose. Great to be back with you.
Great to have you. And Lee Fang reports that the six groups at the center of the Koch brothers operation have already spent $53 million on candidate-specific ads. Lee has a piece in Vice about the misinformation being spread in the media about the Koch brothers' politics. Lee Fang is an investigative fellow at the Nation Institute and co-founder of The Republic Report. He also writes for Vice, Politico, and The Baffler. And Lee joins me in studio. Hi, Lee. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
And on the international front, we are talking about ISIS. Today's guest, Martin Chulov, reports that the group is making very modern military and media advances, but its existence is rooted in religion and old sectarian divides. Martin Chulov is a Middle East correspondent for The Guardian. He has reported from the region since 2005. Hi, Martin. Welcome back to the show.
Always a pleasure, Rose.
Always a pleasure to have you. Well, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and recognize good reporting. So, Lee Fang, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Last Sunday, the New York Times had a great piece by Scott Shane and Ben Hubbard looking at the social media strategies of ISIS. We've seen a lot in the media about ISIS using Twitter or, you know, YouTube to recruit folks both in the region and all over the world, but this piece really laid clear the kind of cutting-edge technology that ISIS has used to make what they're doing almost seem like a movie or a video game to potential recruits. So it's very interesting, and I think the way that this was that their strategy was laid out and summarized in the piece was clarifying.
Well, there have been a lot of stories about that. Why do you think that's so surprising?
Well, at least from my perspective, I don't cover foreign affairs, but in the American media, you've seen terrorist groups, whether it's Al-Qaeda or others, using kind of grainy videos and having to leak their media to Al Jazeera or other outlets. And it's always, when you see this type of content, it's always coming through several different filters, whether they're media or political filters. What ISIS has done to cut through the noise and use social media, like many other political organizations all over the world, is just fascinating. And how they've been able to actually control the narrative and play off the different political tensions here in the U.S. to get their message out, I just think it's really interesting.
Martin, in your latest piece, you write that almost every move ISIS has made has been chronicled in some form, either through shaky handheld mobile phones that have captured battle scenes Blair Witch style, or by applying more sophisticated Hollywood production values. Why do you think the media are really focusing on this? Why is it important?
Because it is cutting through, and it's very definitely getting people's attention. These horrific high-definition beheading videos, people speaking to a carefully laid-down script in one of their online collections of, barbarism or the awful things they've done in the last couple of months. The opening sequence of this is cut straight from the Hurt Locker. It's direct copy. So they're clearly paying a lot of attention to very modern, penetrating methods to get this old school messages of theirs through, and it really is getting some traction.
And the Hurt Locker is that 2009 film about the Iraq War.
Yeah, absolutely.
So thank you for that. So kudos to the New York Times, Scott Shane, and Ben Hubbard. And Martin Chulov, since we're talking with you, Middle East correspondent with The Guardian, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I also liked the New York Times piece, and it was also on ISIS, so they've thrown a lot of resources into covering this phenomenon, and the piece that caught my eye was published yesterday by Tim Arango and the rest of the Baghdad Bureau. And it was a video led piece on one of the sole survivors of a massacre in Tikrit way back in mid-June, where large numbers of Shia soldiers from the Iraqi army were rounded up and executed. This guy survived by feigning death, and they chronicled his journey back to Basra in the deep south and the people he'd met along the way. And I just thought it was an extremely powerful piece of reporting, very expensive piece of reporting too. And that clearly shows a commitment for the Times to continue to do this sort of difficult work. So I'm all for encouraging that. Mm.
All right, so kudos to Tim Arango in Baghdad for that video. Thank you, Martin. And Dave Leventhal with the Center for Public Integrity, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, when you're steeped in covering politics all the time, oftentimes I like to go to a topic that really has nothing to do or is only tangentially related to politics. And I found an article in the New Republic by Kent Russell. It was about Alzheimer's disease. And, you know, science journalism has a way sometimes of being quite technical, quite clinical, and this, in a way I'd really had never read before, brought humanity to an issue and explained the quiet chaos of this disease in such a painfully exquisite way that it was very, very hard to stop reading and almost compelled you to read again and again. I learned more perhaps with that single article about Alzheimer's disease than I ever had about any other article, and would highly recommend it to anyone who of course has had a family member who's suffered from the disease or not, because as the article explains all too clearly, it's affecting millions of people in the United States alone and will only affect more as our population ages.
Yes, especially because we've got 10,000 people turning 65 every day in this country.
And by the time you reach 85, according to this article, and the statistic has been bandied about before, but you have effectively a 1 in 2 chance of contracting Alzheimer's disease.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you for that. So kudos to the New Republic. That's Dave Leventhal with the Center for Public Integrity. And we will put links to these stories at yourcallradio.org. So, Martin, I want to start off with you. You've been reporting on ISIS and its territorial gains in Syria. There have been a lot of headlines about what's happening in Iraq in recent months because they have taken over towns in northern Iraq, driving out hundreds of thousands of people. And the attention is shifting to now what the West must do to stop the group. You were in Iraq, and you've written extensively about this. Why do you think ISIS has been able to proliferate so quickly? What explains that?
Yeah, look, it's a fascinating issue, and I think there are always myriad reasons for something such as this. But if we are to boil them down, I think we could lead with the total failure of the Arab body politic to power share, to respond to the will of the people. Over the last 3 years in particular, but beyond that, way back to 2003, the Sunnis of the heartland of Arabia have been of the view that they've been ousted from the political process. When Saddam Hussein, their key patron in Iraq, was taken down, the Sunnis lost their power base, and into that power base jumped the Shias, who were heavily backed by Iran. And it's long been a view held by the Sunnis in Iraq and in Syria and elsewhere in the region that the invasion in 2003 was actually a U.S.-Iranian plot just to empower the Iranians. Now, you know, people can draw their own conclusions as to whether that's true, but in the Middle East and elsewhere, perception often matters far more than reality. And certainly in the last 3 years, we've seen a process in Syria where an Alawite-led minority, which is firmly aligned to Iran, has done all it could to put down a Sunni majority opposition. And also in Iraq, we've had a Sunni minority who has never reconciled itself to being on the sidelines of power, being marginalized ever more when Nour al-Maliki, who was very much urged on by what was happening next door in Syria, was doing all he could to disenfranchise and to estrange the Sunnis of Iraq. So that's a very, very powerful disaffected pool, a majority in Syria, a minority in Iraq, making upwards of 10 to 15 million people, some of them found the ISIS message very compelling because here was an organization that could do what no political leader or no political organization has been able to do in the last 10 years. And very, very quickly, it was able to overturn the status quo in Iraq. It ran amok in Syria, and it was doing so saying that it was underpinned by a preordained theological drive, which was going to empower these Sunnis in ways that they couldn't have been empowered otherwise. So, to some, this message has proved irresistible, and the ideology that is driving these battle-hardened fighters, they're able to gain ground. They're able to maneuver in three different directions at once, which no Arab military can. So when people are seeing such extraordinary results on the ground, it becomes exponential to some in terms of its appeal.
Can you talk about the challenges involved in reporting on this group, determining who they are, where they're getting their money and their support? What's involved in that?
Well, I guess you could call it fortunate, you could call it a curse, but I've had pretty much a front row view to this for the last 3.5 years. The Islamic State, in its latest incarnation, started in 2013 in April, May. In the 6 to 8 months prior to that, it had been steadily organizing itself in Syria. But as we know, from about 2004 through to 2009, it was a potent aspect of the Iraqi war, first as a buffer to U.S. forces there, but it very quickly spread into a straight-up sectarian conflict with the Shia. So it's been around, it's been at times muted, but since mid-2012, the group has been rapidly reorganizing and recasting itself. And every trip I ever made into Syria or into southern Turkey, there were at least 5 to 6 full-blown jihadists on the plane from Istanbul to Hatay in the south. They weren't hiding. They had jihadi ringtones, jihadi clothes. They were singing songs on the plane. It was obvious where they were going. And so, you know, we could see them on the plane. We could see them at the airport. We saw them at the bus stations. Nobody was stopping them. And, we were able at that time to talk to them, and certainly inside the country in the early months we could talk to them as well. And it became clear that this was a group that was sustaining itself through its own deeds. By and large, it doesn't receive any outside funding, certainly not from a nation state, not from Saudi Arabia or Qatar, but certainly from benefactors across the Gulf. It seems to be funding itself by raiding banks in Syria and Iraq, by selling state-owned enterprises or bits and pieces that it can hock to the Turks. It sells oil to the Syrian regime, and it steals weapons from the Iraqi military, and it's done extremely well in the last 2 years in terms of a startup enterprise.
That is Martin Chulov, Middle East correspondent for The Guardian. He's reported from the region since 2005. He's been reporting on ISIS for the last few years. We're also joined by Dave Leventhal, senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, and Li Feng. He is a fellow with The Nation and co-founder of The Republic Report. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions for Martin about coverage of ISIS, what really strikes you? Because ISIS is leading the headlines, especially with the latest beheading of the journalist Stephen Sotloff. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Ali, do you have any questions for Martin about covering ISIS?
Yeah, I keep seeing these reports about how former Baathist lieutenants or, you know, folks who are in the same tribal group as Saddam Hussein have helped ISIS take areas of northern Iraq, particularly around Tikrit. And they're in some type of alliance with ISIS. But, you know, I haven't seen a really comprehensive reporting on this alliance. I'd like to ask you, you know, is this more of just a sectarian alliance, or are there, is ISIS's well-known ideology, or at least as it's reported, is that something that's being adopted by the former Baathist?
It's a great issue, Lee. It's an alliance of convenience, and that it's a little more than that at this point. The Baathists were secularists in many ways, and they were deemed by the Islamists to be a mortal foe. But since 2009, there has been some kind of an alliance with them in various acts across Iraq. There were four ministries that were blown up in one midsummer day in Baghdad in August 2009. That was a plot that was hatched by former Ba'athists and the jihadists who were at that stage trying to organize themselves in Iraq. That marked the moment where these two former foes decided to get together to work to a common cause. But we've only seen that really play out in a dramatic sense since June. And you're absolutely right, this did take place around Tikrit. That is a village near Tikrit is the birthplace of Saddam Hussein, and it was also a power base of the Ba'ath Party. Most of those, if not all of them, were ousted from the political life and from any sort of power base way back in 2003, and they've been grizzling and snarling from the sidelines ever since. Some of them are very capable military officers, and they did bring their experience to the battlefield in terms of taking Tikrit. It doesn't mean that they are rusted on to the ISIS ideology, although I have heard from some of them in recent days that there are a couple at around about brigadier level who are more Islamic stroke jihadists than they used to be. But by and large, this is a group who is using the momentum that ISIS has to further their own ambitions. And I do anticipate a day in the not too distant future where their ambitions will part ways.
And Dave, do you have a question for Martin?
Yes, I'm curious as to the legitimacy of some of the reports coming out that there are dozens, even hundreds, maybe even thousands of Islamic State members who have U.S. passports or passports to other nations, be it Britain or elsewhere in Europe. What do you know about this, and how legitimate a threat, if this is a threat indeed, is it to the nations where the passport holders may have a greater enhanced degree of access to by virtue of them having a passport?
Right, well, that's another great issue. And most of those people I was speaking about earlier that we used to see on the plane down from Istanbul, they were all foreign passport holders. They were not Turks, many from North Africa, some from Europe. And the numbers are quite stark. There are thought to be around about 150 to 200 U.S. citizens fighting in Syria, about 500 to 600 Brits. There's 300 odd Australians, and almost every European state has 500 to 600 of them. So, at face value, there's a significant potential for a homeland security issue. Now, one of the things that the various intel agencies are looking for is whether there is an effort at this point to bring home any of this experience that these new recruits or battle hardened ideologues have found on the battlefields of northern Syria and bring them back to from where they came. At this point, there hasn't been anything to suggest it. Every intelligence agency in the Western world is focused very, very heavily on it, and there is potential for it to happen. But it does seem as though those who have gone to Syria have done so because they believe that they are acting out a preordained apocalyptic showdown with a mortal foe. It doesn't appear at this point to be a recruiting ground or a training ground to go back home and act out any terrorist deeds there. It's not to say that it won't change, but certainly from all of the reports that I'm getting from people who are members of this organization or are disaffected with it or in some way aligned to it, there hasn't been any definitive attempt to use their experience from Syria elsewhere in the world.
All right, thank you for that question, Dave. We've got a question from Ted in San Francisco. Hi, Ted, welcome to the show. Hello, did we drop Ted? Ted wanted to know more, Martin, about who's sponsoring ISIS and where they're getting their funding.
Right, okay. I mean, this comes up a lot, and so it should. It's a very valid issue, but as I said earlier, the organization does appear to be pretty much self-funded. Take when it rode into Mosul back in mid-June 2014, a couple of months ago, when one afternoon it was able to loot $480 million from Mosul banks. The following day, it seized all of the weapons from the Iraqi army arsenals in the north of the country because five divisions simply cut and ran. They fled, and they left every single U.S.-supplied weapon that they had. So ISIS was simply able to hoover it all up and take it back into Syria with them. And conservatively, that booty in itself was valued at more than $1.5 billion. In addition, it's been selling oil to the Syrian regime from the eastern oil fields that it seized a year ago, and that's an effort between $1 to $3 million per day. It's stolen, it's looted most of the antiquity fields or archaeological digs in the west and north of Syria. It's conservatively sold around $40 million worth of antiquities, and it's also selling bits and pieces of state-owned enterprises, you know, waterworks, gasworks, things like that, to the Turks. So it's not short of cash flow. And in terms of the Gulf states, there are private patrons that are sending money to ISIS, but people have looked very, very hard for any evidence of state sponsorship, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Gulfies themselves, and the Qataris are definitely sponsoring the Muslim Brotherhood movement in northern Syria, and there is some crossover to some Al Qaeda groups there, but it's certainly not direct. It is indirect, and the Saudis, on the other hand, were very late to the party. They only started to fund early last year, and they were very careful to send any cash that they were sending straight to more mainstream opposition groups.
I wanted to also ask you, Martin, about a piece you wrote for The Guardian, James Foley and Fellow Freelancers, Exploited by Pared-Back Media Outlets. In this new age of journalism, publishers should not abdicate responsibility by hiding behind low budgets. You write about how much of the reporting coming out of the Middle East and North Africa has been the work of journalism's newest hands, freelance journalists who get no support, training, or budgets. Can you talk a little bit about this? What changes have you seen over the years, especially with the freelancers going to the Middle East?
Well, I guess it's been multifaceted. From about 2009 onwards, certainly the print media outlets around the world really did hit the wall in terms of their revenue streams. That put a lot of pressure on foreign coverage in particular. It was difficult to maintain expensive bureaus in difficult parts of the world, Baghdad in particular. When the Arab Awakenings kicked off in early 2011, there very much was a thirst for coverage, and there weren't the people deployed that there might have been otherwise. At the same time, there were lots of new news organizations popping up who didn't have a network or any sort of resources out there. They were looking for people to file to them. Now, North Africa in particular, Egypt and Libya presented some great opportunities for some young people who wanted to try their hand at reporting or corresponding. They were drawn to the craft for the same reasons that I was 20 years ago, when we certainly can't blame them for turning up and saying, well, you know, we're here and we're looking for people to buy our work. But what did happen in Libya is that I guess there did seem to be very much a lowering of the bar in terms of allowing some young freelance reporters to take risks that were not mitigated in any way by news organizations who did have a right to ensure that they were safe as well as being published. I think, you know, there was very little training. There was a lot of behavior that was quite frankly reckless in Libya and elsewhere. But Libya was nowhere near as menacing or as dangerous as Syria was. And by the time we got to Syria, and the focus had switched there by pretty much late 2011, early 2012, a lot of risks were being taken. And there were also news organizations who were taking work from freelancers who were not insured, who were not trained, who didn't have any medical training whatsoever, and were simply wandering across very, very dangerous borders without any protections, and you know, having their work published for pretty well meager rates.
And Martin, hold that thought. After the break, we'll continue this discussion about freelancers, especially freelancers who go overseas and risk their lives. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call Radio on your local public radio, KALW. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation at On Your Call. On the phone, by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, it's quite simple. You just call toll-free 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK. You're tuned to your local public radio, KALW, San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with filmmakers from the Legacy Film Festival on Aging. It kicks off on September 12th in San Francisco. Roughly 10,000 people in the U.S. turn 65 every day. So what does it mean to be an elder today? What are the prevailing perceptions about the elderly, and how can we reclaim the positive power of that title? That's on Monday. Tuesday, we'll be joined by Rebecca Solnit, author of Men Explain Things to Me. On Wednesday, we will mark the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement by talking about a new play that's kicking off soon. And Thursday, we will talk with Dana Goldstein about her new book, looking at the history of teaching. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. We're joined by Dave Leventhal, senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, where he leads its Consider the Source project team, investigating the influence of money in politics. Martin Chulov is Middle East correspondent for The Guardian. He's reported from the region since 2005. And Li Fang is an investigative fellow at The Nation, co-founder of The Republic Report. He also writes for Vice, Politico, and The Baffler. And Li, you just got back from a reporting trip to Honduras. What are your thoughts on what Martin says about freelancers? I mean, nowadays, if you want to report from the Middle East, a lot of freelancers are doing this because media outlets just don't have the budgets.
Yeah, that's right. I can't even imagine what many of these freelance journalists go through in places like Syria or northern Iraq. You know, I mostly cover domestic politics, but this is one of my first trips covering something in another country, and Honduras is a very hostile place for journalists, for NGOs. It's they've killed the largest number of journalists murdered outside of a war zone is in Honduras. You know, and taking these types of trips, they're difficult. You know, I'm very fortunate in that I have an investigative fellowship from the Nation Institute, and they help support this trip. But, you know, going into a community, meeting people, talking to people, I needed a driver, a translator at times, a fixer to help figure out some of these more complicated meetings. And at the same time, someone to guide me around, because I don't know the cultural norms of a country like this, especially a fairly dangerous country. You know, when we visited one community in Honduras, the militarized police came out and started shooting their guns.
Wow.
You know, I felt safe knowing that I was a Westerner, you know, with an American passport. They probably wouldn't target me, but you never know. And for folks who are trying to, you know, burn their own path by figuring this out on their own and not having insurance or just a media outlet to back them up if things get sticky, I don't know how they do it. And I my heart goes out to all the people who do risk their lives in these zones. It is unfortunate, though, that media outlets are continually cutting back their budget for this, foreign media, or creating foreign bureaus. I mean, that's just something that American news media don't do anymore. Mm. They completely cut it back, except for a few notable outlets like the Wall Street Journal or New York Times. But for independent media in particular, you know, you're seeing a lot of magazines, a lot of media outlets losing their revenue model, and no one's really figured out a way to cover things in the future.
And Martin reports that in Libya, many freelance reporters worked with no insurance, no expenses, and in some cases, even airfare to get them home again. So, I mean, freelancers are really putting a lot on the line to get these stories. Dave, do you think that the execution of the two American journalists, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, will cause media outlets to change their practices?
It's unclear as to whether it'll change their practices, but when you talk about media outlets these days, there are media outlets that maybe 5, certainly 10 years ago, wouldn't be considered such, which today are the ones that are disseminating the kind of content that's really proving to be the most egregious, salacious, call it what you will. So speaking specifically about the videos themselves, the propaganda that's going out, I think there's a competition that does today exist that again, maybe wouldn't have existed about a decade ago to put as much out there as possible, even if it's very graphic, very disturbing. And there have been news outlets, the New York Post might be one example, that have come under a lot of criticism for walking right up to the line of what a lot of people consider to be decent for a more mainstream publication, even going over that line. So at least in media circles right now, there's sort of a conversation, a rolling, roiling conversation going on about what exactly is acceptable for a more mainstream or traditional or even, you know, cutting-edge online publication versus what a non-news organization that still trades in media would be doing simply because they have the ability to do so, and they have a distribution method and platform that's as big as the world. All you need is an internet connection.
Well, let's go next to William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I always like to try to learn the perspective of people from elsewhere, and as the guests have more experience, certainly, than do I, in this field, I would like to ask them the following. There is in the United States terrible anger, great anger, about the death of Mr. Foley and the other American. And as a matter of fact, the vice president said, we're going to chase them to hell and the gates of hell. You remember that.
Yeah.
At any rate, however, for someone living, say, in the Middle East, do they ever say, well, you know, it's too bad that happened to that guy, but, you know, that drone that the United States sent to such and such a place, and it could be almost anywhere, that killed 20 people at a wedding party, you know, that really should be put in the balance, too, so I'm not so upset about what happened to the Americans. And I wonder whether that kind of perspective gets into the way that people gets into the thinking of people in other countries who are subjected to U.S. actions.
Well, we have a related email that says, it seems that all this blowback or fallout in the Middle East represents a continuing failure of U.S. foreign policy, especially starting with the pretextual invasion of Iraq. Martin, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think certainly the drone strikes resonate considerably across the Arab world, in particular in Yemen. And They are deemed by many who are fighting, whether it's against the Yemeni government, whether it's against the Saudis next door, or against the Americans, as a reason for continuing this militancy. It does come up in Iraq as well, and certainly since the drone strikes have been hitting the Islamic State in the north of the country, they've certainly been saying, well, this is a reason that we're not valuing the fate of your citizens because you've been going after us in this manner for not just for the last couple of months, but they certainly trace back the origins of their conflict or their contemporary conflict with the Americans back to 2003 in Iraq. But certainly the issue of drones is underreported, it's certainly a matter of much discontent, not just within Islamic circles, but on the mainstream Sunni and Shia street in the Middle East.
All right. Well, Martin, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you. That is Martin Chuloff. He is Middle East correspondent for The Guardian. He's been reporting from the region since 2005, and you can find his articles at yourcallradio.org. And sticking with us for the rest of the hour is Dave Leventhal, senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, where he covers money and politics, and Li Feng, an investigative reporter, investigative fellow at the Nation Institute. He writes for Vice, Politico, and The Baffler, and he co-founded The Republic Report. So let's dive in here and talk about the midterm elections. They're in full force, expected to be the most expensive in history, although I say that every time there's a new election nowadays. And you both report on there's so much money being spent. Dave, the Center for Public Integrity found that by November, more than $150 million in TV ads would be spent. So far, 428,000 TV ads have aired, even in some very small states. How does this compare with last midterm election? What really stands out for you this time around?
Sure, and I'll do you one up here in that 150 million figure isn't even going toward November. It's as of late August.
Wow.
So that number is going to be significantly higher, and it is in and of itself a very conservative estimate that wraps in not only the kind of television advertisements that overtly advocate for or against a candidate, but also to ones that are maybe a half a step down from that, where they mention a candidate, they talk about a candidate, they're in the teeth of a very hot contested Senate race, for example, but yet don't overtly advocate for or against the candidate's election. But the bottom line is that if you live in a competitive battleground state for the Senate or even a competitive battleground House race seat, you're effectively being inundated morning, noon, and night with messages in a way that wouldn't have even been possible a few years back. And much of this, as many of your listeners likely know to some degree, has been animated by a series of federal court decisions that have made it easier for political groups of any political stripe to raise and spend unlimited amounts of money and pour this into advertising, to messaging. And that comes on TV. It comes on the radio, too. But increasingly, we're seeing some of this spending, even a good significant amount of this spending in some races, migrating online and even going toward efforts that you would consider to be very much part and parcel of a candidate's own campaign, get out to vote efforts, door knocking, phone banking, grassroots type stuff. And you have super PACs and nonprofit organizations getting into this sphere, unlike they really have been in the past couple of election go-arounds since the seminal Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission decision in 2010 and a few others that are very important to this kind of new regime of campaign money that we've had for the past 4 years now.
And again, it's important to note that if a group like Americans for Prosperity does not overtly call for the defeat of a candidate, they can avoid telling federal election regulators how much money they're pumping into their message machine. Right.
Yes, and here in until up until September, the groups such as that, these what they're called technically 501c4 nonprofit organizations, even though they're not supposed to have a primary purpose of engaging in political activity, they've nonetheless done so to a significant degree, and have been spending in some cases tens of millions of dollars on advertisements and messaging that any average person would consider to be absolutely political in nature. Won't get into the technical details of it all, but really the bottom line with that is that the Republican groups have been doing this pretty much from the get-go and have been doing this at an incredibly strong degree. You mentioned Americans for Prosperity. It's one of the several groups, many groups, in fact, that are supported by the Koch brothers.
Right.
And if you add all of that up, we found and reported in one of our articles this week at the Center for Public Integrity that the top six Koch-related groups have already sponsored more than 44,000 advertisements just in Senate races alone. So that's through late August. You can only imagine what it's going to be by the time November rolls around. But the countervailing point to that, too, is that Democrats have gotten really, really smart to the way that that politics works these days. On one hand, they're decrying oftentimes big money in politics, but also, too, acknowledging that if they don't engage in the system the way that it is right now, that they're effectively shooting themselves in the foot. And one group in particular, Patriot Majority U.S. say is been a Democratic group that already has spent $7 million on overt political advertisements, and that too is a dark money group. It just happens to be a liberal dark money group.
Mm-hmm.
So still more going on the Republican side than the Democratic side, but the gap is closing compared to where it was a couple years ago.
The Dems are definitely trying to catch up, and we'll talk about some of those Democratic groups in a minute, but I wanted to stick with the Koch brothers because your group also found that one out of every 10 television ads are directly connected to the Koch brothers?
in Senate races so far this year.
Okay.
So, and that's across all the Senate races, but especially in some of the really key battleground races. We're talking North Carolina and Colorado, Arkansas, Alaska, Louisiana, and several others. So if you, again, live in one of those states, expect to hear a whole lot from Koch brother-related groups in addition to a variety, a couple of dozen in some states, different outside organizations that are very much philosophically aligned with certain candidates, but by law cannot have an absolute direct relationship with them where they're coordinating their efforts.
It's kind of amazing. Kentucky, a fairly rural state, has already aired 37,500 TV ads. And again, one out of every 10 Senate ads is connected to the Koch brothers. Lee, you have written extensively about the Koch brothers. Your recent piece in Vice is about major media outlets spreading misinformation about the Koch brothers, who you say are behind much of these, the infrastructure on the right as selfless libertarians. Matthew Cooper of Newsweek says they are, quote, more libertarian than Republican, more Austrian economics than Christian Coalition. Daniel Shulman, author of a new book on the Koch family, recently told The Daily Show that the brothers do not, quote, align with Republicans at all, adding that David Koch has come out and said he's pro-gay marriage, they're pro-reproductive rights. So what's the truth?
Well, it's, you know, the Koch brothers, in the last 4 years, 5 years, they've received a lot of media attention. And over the years, particularly this year, they've hired PR firms, they've brought in branding specialists, they've put on commercials to kind of reintroduce themselves to the American public. And in particular, in the political media, they've worked with reporters to argue, sometimes directly, that, you know, all of this election activity that they're engaged in, all of this lobbying, it's really to help America and to reestablish libertarian principles in American society. That means less government intrusion into business, but also less into our personal lives. Social libertarian values, promoting gay marriage or reproductive rights. And this image that they've spun has been adopted by much of the media. The New York Times, even in the news section, frequently calls them libertarian. Daniel Shulman and other folks. But if you look at where the Kochs have put their money, actually some of the largest social conservative groups in the country are receiving huge checks from the Koch brothers. In some cases, the vast majority of their budget comes directly from the Koch brothers. So you have groups like Concerned Women for America that just this week in North Carolina had a huge anti-abortion rally. You know, they're calling folks baby killers who support abortion rights. They're talking about the rights of God being violated by having gay marriage laws around the country. They're using this as an election issue in some more conservative parts of the country. And the vast majority of their budget comes from the Koch brothers. And it's not just Concerned Women for America. The Susan B. Anthony list is running advertisements on these kind of social conservative issues. You have Heritage Action really pushing right-wing groups and organizing them on Capitol Hill. So it would be inaccurate to say that the Koch brothers are focused only on economic issues. If you look at where their spending patterns are, it's certainly with the social right, which is and they're different than I think a lot of the business groups in the Republican Party that actually have eschewed social conservatism. They've cut their ties with many religious right groups. However, the Koch brothers are writing the checks still.
Why do you think they're given a pass on this?
Well, it's a compelling media narrative. People like this idea of these selfless billionaires who want to resurrect libertarianism in society. You have a lot of reporters who I think self-identify as kind of libertarian, and they want a patron, even if they don't necessarily subscribe to all of the Koch ideology. You know, they support gay marriage. They're kind of wary of big government spending programs, or that they have a negative perception of welfare. So they like this idea, and that's my perspective of why so many reporters repeat this mantra.
Do Americans know about the Koch brothers? I mean, in our world, of course, people do. Media junkies do. But do average Americans, I mean, they're spending almost $300 million this election cycle. They make $7 million every hour, according to a recent Huffington Post piece. about Richard Fink, the Koch brothers' top strategist, recently said that the minimum wage leads directly to fascism and the homeless should, quote, get off your ass and work hard like we did. But do most Americans know about these guys?
I would say yes and no. I don't know. I doubt that most Americans know the Koch story and understand their ideology and what they've done to this country in terms of their policy agenda. But I think Americans intrinsically know that wealthy people like the Koch brothers have outsized influence over our politics, that politicians listen to them and they don't listen to the concerns that people face every day, from education to transportation, you know, and the jobless crisis. You know, and that's the question for a lot of these Democrats who are now running against the Koch brothers, talking about them on the stump, having ads that mention the Koch brothers. In certain parts of the country, that might not resonate. But I think the general theme that there are a small group of people, small group of billionaires with really extremist views on the economy, are getting more and more influence and dictating where we go as a country. I think people actually do respond to that.
And David, the Koch brothers are getting a lot of attention, but the Daily Beast reported that the casino mogul Sheldon Adelson is going to spend about $100 million on Senate races in the midterm. He's writing checks to Americans for Prosperity, which was founded by the Kochs, Crossroads GPS, founded by Karl Rove, and the Republican Jewish Coalition, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. But he doesn't get as much attention as the Kochs.
And I would say to that yes and no as well. He definitely got a lot of attention during the 2012 election cycle, in part because he was just so out front and almost proud of the amount of money that he was pouring into that particular race, which, give or take a bit, was right around $100 million as well. But a couple of the groups that you just named are not the types of groups that he was donating to during the 2012 election, which were super PACs. And super PACs, the big difference with them compared to a nonprofit group that's politically active is that super PACs do have to disclose who their donors are. So we all knew who that Sheldon Adelson was supporting a number of different groups, most notably the super PACs that were supporting first Newt Gingrich and then Mitt Romney. So this time, even though it's been well reported that he is getting involved during the midterm elections here, the types of organizations that he's giving to are a bit different because they don't have to be so out front and don't have to be so public about who's supporting them and to what degree. But, you know, if you're a gambler, you definitely know who he is. And he's definitely had a profile, public profile, that is a little bit different than the Kochs. I can think of an article that we wrote where we got an email from him in response to a question and had to confirm it with his secretary that it was him, and indeed was. He's a very quirky individual who is very passionate about the issues that he cares about and isn't afraid to, from time to time, mix it up in public, either with reporters or with other folks. Because he feels it's his prerogative, number one, and he feels it is important enough where he's going to go and darn well do so.
Lee, you just wrote a 10-page piece for The Baffler about the U.S. Chamber of Commerce called The Business of America, America's Dirty Tricks. What did you learn? I mean, what is it like to report on the Chamber of Commerce? Are they transparent, or how did you do the background on this?
The chamber is not transparent. but, you know, what's interesting is that they've had kind of this omnipresent role in American politics for almost over a century now. And they're not really recognized as the big players in Washington. When people think about who's running things in Washington, they think of unions or billionaires or maybe a think tank or a certain lobbyist. They don't think of the U.S. chamber as an individual institution that has had many different iterations throughout the decades. You know, it's kind of started as this hard right, let's mobilize the business community so they have a voice in Washington. And then it kind of careened towards the left, where you had a lot of the very wealthy industrialists in this country saying, let's fight the New Deal, let's kind of cause an insurrection in this country against President Roosevelt. And you had the chamber actually in a conciliatory role of actually playing the middleman and figuring out ways that business and capital can work with labor. But at the same time, you've had the time period after World War II, where the chamber laid the groundwork for red baiting and McCarthyism by drawing up lists of suspected communists, drawing up lists of labor union supporters, and saying that these are the threats to the United States. So you see the chamber, actually the leadership of the chamber, which is elected by a council of businessmen, really having a big role in American society, but it hasn't been acknowledged. Mm. And you had throughout the 70s and early 90s, you had the moderate leadership again in control of the chamber. But for the last 15, 20 odd years, you've had Tom Donohue, which is kind of the same mold of the chamber in the post-war era, where, you know, it's destroy his agenda is to destroy his political opponents, and that's through aggressive campaigning, that's through helping to elect the Tea Party, that's actually in a plot that was exposed by a splinter group from Anonymous, the group of hackers, that the chamber was negotiating with a set of defense contractors to use the same type of spyware that our military uses to go after Al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. and to use that proprietary technology to go after labor unions and to go against journalists who were reporting on the chamber. Now, that deal was never finalized, but that kind of gives you a grasp of where the chamber is today, and that they're moving the country hard to the right, particularly on certain business issues.
You report that they've got a $200 million annual budget, and at the moment, the D.C. media claims the chamber is, quote, at war with the far-right fringe of the Republican establishment, but that's really not the case when you look at the policies they are fighting for?
No, here's the interesting thing. The chamber came back into the news during the government shutdown around this time last year, and the chamber said that they would get rid of the folks who are demanding a shutdown. But if you look at where they've come down on Republican primaries and Republican elections all throughout this year, and Dave could maybe speak to this, they've been supporting the government shutdown folks. So nothing's changed.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we will definitely continue following this, and we should do a show about the chamber. Again, Lee Fang's report, The Business of America is Dirty Tricks, Meet the United States Chamber of Commerce from the Baffler. It's at yourcallradio.org. And you can also read Dave's pieces about all of the Senate races, along with one about Democrats embracing the McCutcheon decision. Dave Leventhal is senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Lee Fang is an investigative fellow at The Nation and co-founder of The Republic Report. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What does it mean to be an elder today? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with the filmmakers from the Legacy Film Festival on Aging, which kicks off on September 12th in San Francisco. Roughly 10,000 people in the U.S. turn 65 every day. So what are the prevailing perceptions about the elderly, and how can we reclaim the positive power of that title for young and old alike? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
The next Your Call, Monday morning at 10 a.m. right here on your local public radio.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Eric Wayne is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.